Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that while this is our Rethink the Week, we have a great panel of talkers, but we are Zooming on Sunday afternoon, so if something should happen Sunday night, maybe we'll talk about it on Tuesday. But before we do anything else, we begin every single day, and we have for months, everyone, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. He spoke truth to power. He was an immigrant that understood what patriotism meant, and he kept assuring his father that everything would be okay because, after all, this is America. What we're finding out is virtually nothing is okay. Now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear, for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, gentlemen, get ready for our Rethink the Week. Every time I think it's a week, it feels like a year, but hey, what are we going to do? Joining us, as he always does, is Dean Spiliotis. He's a professor at Southern New Hampshire University. He teaches civics, and he's a presidential scholar. He also has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. You can also hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure. We have my good friend, Stephen Pimpare, who I got to meet because we both did 1776 together, which was very exciting.
Oh, we didn't actually do the show. Let's be clear.
Oh, no, that's right. We actually, this is a great story. They performed 1776 in White River Junction, Vermont. They performed it for a series of days, but because it was so controversial, because obviously the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that followed embraced the concept of slavery, which makes a lot of people still very unhappy. But we were like a talk back after the musical. And it was an incredible experience, Stephen, don't you think, that talk back?
It was great fun. Great fun.
It was great fun. He teaches at UNH Manchester. He is a scholar at the Carsey Institute, a fellow there. His area of expertise is poverty and low income and all the stories that are actually going to be, I think, front and center as we move into 2021, because this pandemic is an economic catastrophe. And joining us from New Jersey, I believe, is Robert Hennelly. Robert Hennelly writes for The Chief Leader. He writes for InsiderNJ.com. He writes for Salon.com. He also is at
Stuck Nation.
Pete, what is at Stuck Nation? Do a lot of writers write for it? Is that what
it is? No, it is something that in 2007, I kept feeling like mid-career, I was writing the same stories about the country. Right. So I said, this is a stuck nation. I had no idea how stuck we would be.
What a ride.
Does moving backwards count as stuck?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. Well, I'm going to do something a little unusual today. I'm going to open with a comment that was posted on my Facebook page. And it's from a guy named Robert P., who I know. And he wrote this, and I think in a lot of ways it sort of sets the stage for sort of what's happening in this country, and with Donald Trump holding these public events where nobody is masking, people are going back to school and are terrified because we're seeing a spike in the number of COVID cases. Don't teach in Iowa because Iowa is like the center of disaster when it comes to COVID. But this is what Robert P. wrote. This morning at the supermarket, they had a no mask, no entry rule. And one goes into the store when one comes out. So we're waiting in a short line on the walkway. An old guy, no mask, struts to the door. And I said, sir, the line is over here, which was echoed by others waiting. He stops and glares. A store employee came out to retrieve carts from the parking lot. Me, Robert. We have a bit of a problem here. Old guy glares at me. Employee says to put on mask and join the line if you want to get in. Points to the placard. Old guy glares at him, then makes the grave mistake of turning back to me to say, tell him. Me? I'm not telling him a damn thing. You find a mask and you join this line. Old guy, I have my rights. Me, as in Robert. And it's plain you've never, gosh darn, bothered to learn of responsibilities that go with our rights. People in line go, yeah, great. Old man glares at me, turns and flounces off in a petulant, self-centered dudgeon. From the line, yay, Mr. P. Turn around, startled. I had you for U.S. History Civics last year. Much merriment and applause. Sometimes I just can't stand my damn generation and its perverse, self-centered entitlement. And that was posted on my Facebook page. But to a large extent, I feel like, you know, New Hampshire is the only state in New England, you guys, that doesn't have a mask mandate. Everyone else does. So it's being leapt up to people like Robert P. and the poor kid who's pointing to the placard, or the, you know, the teachers or the superintendents trying to figure out what to do because they're not getting the backing and the guidance from the governor. But I'm going to start with you, Dean Spiliotis, my civic scholar and presidential scholar. Our governor is trying to sort of be a mugwump. He's trying to sort of embrace the Trump base, even though he keeps saying, oh, but I think you should wear your mask. And oh, I wear a mask. And I was just at a funeral and everybody was wearing a mask. He wears it, but at the same time, he doesn't give like any kind of authority by saying there should be a mask mandate. And I feel like that's what's happening with Donald Trump, is that Donald Trump has so politicized this that the situation is not getting better with COVID. And we're entering into a situation now with fall, with school, with the flu season, and COVID not going away, but probably coming back with a vengeance, Dean.
Yeah, you know, he certainly has been aided in this attempt to walk a fine line. And he's walking, as you said, I think you described quite aptly the fine line that he's trying to walk.
Right.
I think he's been aided by the fact that we haven't had any huge, by national standards, outbreaks. If you look at the town by town reporting out of active coronavirus cases, with a few exceptions like Manchester, Nashua, Derry, and a few other towns, I think Durham because of UNH now, most towns have just a couple of cases. So I think that it's easy to kind of try to have it both ways when you're not up against a huge outbreak. I think if we had hundreds and hundreds of cases active right now, or we were still back like we were in the spring, adding 80 or 110 cases a day, it'd be a lot more difficult for him to pull this off. I will say you have to look at the context in which he's trying to win re-election. If you look in the Republican Party in New Hampshire, we just had the primary on Tuesday where both of the Trump-endorsed candidates, Matt Maurer in the first CD and Corky Messner in the Senate race, they both won. Yeah. So whatever is left of the Republican Party in New Hampshire, and we know a lot of people like Jennifer Horn and Tom Rath and others who who have sort of spoken out against what's going on, for better or worse, that's the party. And the party is Trump's party, the folks who are still in it for the most part. That said, he's also playing into a New Hampshire tradition of governors kind of being this sort of separate thing that, you know, it's all about New Hampshire. You only deal with the national scene to the extent that you absolutely have to. And we've seen, you know, John Lynch in 2010 was a great example. You know, progressives were complaining about him until it turned out he was literally the only Democrat who won in 2010. Right. So we all know what Sununu is doing. I think he's been aided by the situation on the ground, but he's got to deal with the reality of the state party being Trump's party.
So I'm going to go to the other New Hampshire resident, Stephen Pimper. And Stephen, the thing that does aid and abet him is we're surrounded by states that have clamped down on COVID. And I always remind people, you got to look at geography, everyone. We should all be taking geography lessons. Because if you look at New Hampshire is this long, slender state. We're all borders and no depth. I mean, let's be honest, we're like a stick, okay? So we're surrounded by Maine with their kind of demands that are being placed on them, and Vermont and Massachusetts. So in a lot of ways, we're protected, Stephen, just because we're kind of cocooned by people that behave well. The only thing I worry about right now is that we're entering color season. Are people going to travel? I don't know. Then we have the ski season. Are people going to come up and ski? I don't know. And then we have all the issues of being indoors and all the sort of the challenges of how do you conduct life and business when we know as soon as you really are forced indoors, that's the way you contract COVID.
You know, I think in some ways that should the reality on the ground that you and Dean have both described changed, I think the policies are going to follow suit. And whatever disagreements I might have with the governor around a host of policy issues, I think that by and large, he has done a pretty decent job of managing the epidemic in the state. And from my perspective, has also done an admirable job of foregrounding our principal public health officials. And that, I mean, even sort of the relatively subtle stuff, right, is that when he does a press conference, it's usually the chief health officials who are the first individuals to speak, with the governor then coming in afterwards, which I think is exactly right, right? This is a discussion about a public health crisis. Let the people who actually know what they're talking about lead in that regard. You know, I will say that, you know, people who are, you know, like that old guy are, you know, to some respect, going to be like that old guy, and they're seeking attention and they're looking for a fight and all of those sorts of things. But this is also a much larger problem, right? Is that we do not have a clear, consistent message that is being communicated from the national government across all agencies of the national government. We've got a couple of places that are functioning as propaganda networks undermining public health officials. So at some level, I understand if people are confused and don't understand what it is that they ought to be doing and why.
I want to turn to Bob. And Bob, so we're waiting for this vaccine. The whole thing about the vaccine now is becoming so politicized, it is just terrifying. And people like me who've always advocated for taking vaccines, I'm hearing doctors saying they're not going to take a vaccine. If suddenly Donald Trump pulls one out of his socks, you know, right before the election, they're going to look at it. And because everything he touches is not only politicized, but you almost have the sense that by definition, you're taking bleach. You're not taking a vaccine. I mean, I just feel like the way he packages stuff. But I heard someone describe this, and I wish the Democrats would use this sort of language, that if you don't trust, at least at this point, this sort of, you know, idea of the vaccine coming out of the administration, wearing a mask is a crude vaccine. It is a crude vaccine. In some ways, they said if what 90% of us were wearing masks, we would see the level of COVID transmission drop dramatically. Well, guess what? Taking a vaccine would make COVID drop dramatically. So in a bizarre way, I think the Democrats should not only talk about, you know, that the pandemic is the economy, because until we address the pandemic, we're not going to be able to actually get the economy back. But I think if you're able to sort of say to people, you're looking for a vaccine, you've got one right now. It's called a mask, Bob.
Right. One of the things that this points out is the deterioration of the civic consensus in the United States. And this predates the pandemic, and it's been coming a long time.
Yes.
We saw with the debate over inoculations for children shots, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a source I spoke with for many years on environmental matters, is leading the charge against the vaccines. Right. So the disintegration of common ground comes as a result of, I might say, well-placed distrust in the government. And this has been looming for a long time. And it's, as I said before, you don't get into a pandemic like this just overnight. The stage is set for it. And it's lasted as long as it has, and it's getting traction in the population because of the erosion of public trust. And I'll give you a very good example that's somewhat timely. 9/11, we celebrated that 19th anniversary. What is lost, people don't realize this unless you cover it like I do with the chief leader. You know, every day is 9/11 for me, because we've lost more people, or close to it, from the occupational exposures from the toxic air in lower Manhattan. Yeah. And most people think that 9/11 was a discrete event where close to 3,000 people died. And the reality is because the EPA, under the pressure from the Bush administration and Mayor Giuliani, wanted to return to, wait for it, normalcy and open up Wall Street, they permitted the suppression of data that showed the air was Drano. And so to this day, we've lost over 200 firefighters to occupational exposures, and 55,000 people are dealing with long-term World Trade Center health issues. Now, where is that in the narrative? And every time something like that happens, government loses its credibility. And then when you need the cohesion outside the supermarket, it's not there.
Very good point. Very good point.
Can I ask you a question, though? I'm sorry, Arnie. I certainly hear that. Very good point. But why is the government the bad guy here? Bush was just taking money from his corporate sponsors, but he would do that anyway. And it's not because he's in the government. It's that all of Wall Street was pushing him to do that. The whole capitalist economy was pushing him to do that. And so it's not the government that's the bad guy. It's the fact that the government is listening to Wall Street and doing their bidding. Because if the government was run by Bernie Sanders, they wouldn't be letting people go back to work if the air was filled with toxicity.
I think that when you have a couple of generations of revolving door.
Thank you. I was just going to go there.
You have exactly. People that, and this goes back decades, where there's a professional civil service, which indeed are the career people who are fish and wildlife scientists, EPA scientists, CDC scientists. They commit their entire life in the public interest. They can make more money in the private sector. But you have wave after wave of both parties coming in at the political level.
Right.
And then corrupting this very process. And so by the time, when time comes down, when you need universal cooperation, you've eroded public confidence. And that's all I'm saying.
And it's bipartisan, everyone. I mean, let's look at Mary Jo White, the head of the SEC under Barack Obama. I mean, I want people to know that it may not be as extreme as what we're seeing, obviously, with Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump has taken everything and he's gone over the deep end in the sense that he's trashed every institution. There is an amazing article, and maybe I wasn't going to go there right away, but I think in some ways I need to. The article was entitled 10 Ways Trump is Becoming a Dictator. And if you look at the 10 ways, I'm going to just read them quickly because each one of them, here's the list. A systematic effort to intimidate the media. Absolutely. Two, building an official pro-Trump media network. We all know about Fox. Politicizing the civil service, military, National Guard, or the domestic security agencies. Four, using government surveillance against domestic political opponents. Five, using state power to reward corporate backers and punish opponents. Six, stacking the Supreme Court. Seven, enforcing the law for only one side. Eight, really rigging the system. Nine, fear-mongering. 10, demonizing the opposition. Oh my God, Dean Spiliotis, I'm looking at these 10 things and I'm thinking all of those, there were little pieces of it in a lot of the administrations, probably since Ronald Reagan. I mean, Jimmy Carter didn't do any of that stuff. But since Reagan, we've seen bits of it, but they've been building and building and building. And now Donald Trump has checked off, Dean, every single box, box. How do we hold an election when all those boxes have been checked off and anyone thinks, one, it'll be fair, there won't be an incredible voter suppression, and two, no matter what the results, all those pieces that I just read off to you are going to kick into gear, and that's going to mean he is going to not only question the result, but I'm not sure he's going to leave the stage.
Yeah, you know, and traditionally we would have said, well, our national institutions have a way of kind of holding and kind of muddling through in the end. You know, it may be kind of incremental, it may be a little bit sluggish, but our system of checks and balances ends up working in the end. There's a lot of anxiety out there among people who are concerned that maybe it won't hold this time and that there are a variety of possible nightmare scenarios for what might follow after November 3rd. I mean, what it's really been reduced to for most people is simply having a sufficiently large turnout that he won't have any realistic opportunity to use any of these kinds of levers of power to hold on to office. You know, who knows what's going to happen at this point. I will say, you mentioned Ronald Reagan, and for many years I taught an academic article in my presidency class that talks about how Reagan really revolutionized regulatory review. He moved regulatory review into the OMB, basically created a bottleneck in right. which anything that didn't meet his ideological considerations was not implemented. And he also, more than any other president at that point, reached down into the bureaucracy to appoint like-minded individuals and basically shrunk the bureaucracy from within. And right. I see a little bit of that. Some of the Trump folks are maybe a little bit shadier in terms of their background, but it's the same kind of behavior in which you put people in positions of power whose interests are kind of antithetical to the mission of the agency that they're in charge of, or even if they're like a deputy, they can still do a lot of damage.
Well, you know, so Stephen, what people don't understand is they've heard of something called prosecutorial discretion. That means that the prosecutor doesn't have to necessarily go after everyone. They can make certain decisions as to where they want to go. They focus their attention based on their discretion. Well, at the regulatory level, there is regulatory discretion. And that's exactly what, in a way, Dean was pointing to. Because when you put people in that basically want to undermine the very institution that they're in charge of, you know that their regulatory discretion is going to be, they're going to either, you know, they're not going to favor the person who's being polluted. They're going to favor the polluter. And that's really what you see with Donald Trump. I mean, take a look at every institution where he's been able to put people in, and the people that he's put in, whether it's the post office, whether it's the EPA, whether it's the Department of Energy, now it's even within the health department, you're seeing people who literally, their goal and their raison d'etre is to undermine what the whole purpose was of that agency.
And the, you know, this is one of the things that you also see, particularly among comparative politics scholars, when they look at slides toward authoritarian regimes. They will look at hollowing out of expertise in executive agencies, and we have seen this really from the start. I think it started probably most pronounced with the State Department. We've seen that right in the impeachment hearings, but we also have seen it in just the sheer number of career Foreign Service officers and civil service servants in the State Department who have been leaving the State Department because of their concern that they simply cannot function. This is happening throughout the agencies. Remember, this is happening also at the same time where, as Dean pointed out, you've got ramping up the Reagan habit of installing chief administrators whose goals are antithetical to the mission of the agency themselves. And at the same time, you've got the systematic sidelining of inspectors general and others who could check that executive hour. Right? So you're intentionally making these agencies unable to function, which arguably inevitably shifts power away from those agencies that are historically run by career civil servants with shared goals under Republican or Democratic administrations. You're shifting that power over to the president himself.
Well, and that's frightening. And then you're also beginning to realize that now every state is on their own. There is no question that you're going to get the kind of support that you think you need, that you get to get the kind of guidance that you think you need. I mean, I'm going to go to you, Bob, because I'm thinking about the Postal Service, which right now is at the center of this conversation that we're having right now. And I did get that mailing from the Postal Service about mail-in voting. So here is a Postal Service that's basically being dismantled as we speak. Donald Trump is basically trashing the idea and saying, by definition, voting by mail is basically fraudulent. And then the Postal Service thinks, you know, sends out a mailing as if they're aiding and abetting you and being helpful in providing you with information at your fingertips in order to vote by mail. And it turns out they're being sued because the information coming out of the Postal Service, no surprise, turns out to be inaccurate and not helpful. Holy moly. I mean, you can't make this up. It's a made-for-TV movie, but it is terrifying me on every single level, because the Democrats are pushing, you know, lick a stamp and mail your ballot, and the Republicans are saying, show up in person. It doesn't matter whether you die or not, wear a mask or socially distance. He's preparing them for that. Just show up on election day, because I want the result and I want it now.
Well, one of the things, the Chief Leader was founded in 1897. We've been covering the civil service that whole entire time.
Wow.
One of the things that has come up, and this happened very early on, we've been talking about, if we use the analogy of the ship of state, what happens on the bridge with the people that are the officers of the flag. But what's been happening in the engine room, that is all of the workers, the 2 million workers that make up the civil service, right, is dismantling that. And that is new. Because historically, even with Ronald Reagan, when he laid off the air traffic controllers, which is a huge blow for labor, there was a bipartisan, going back to Garfield when the civil service was established, that it was good to have a meritocracy for these permanent civil service positions, because there was a period of time where all these positions were sold,
right,
and it was part of a patronage machine.
Right.
And what Trump did, and people like Mulvaney that were around him, and I think it was more his minions than Trump, was leaving key positions open. So the general counsel for the Federal Labor Relations Board, they left the general counsel position open. Because what Trump did is and he tried to drive all of the public unions that had been in the federal government since 1962, since John Kennedy signed the collective bargaining agreement. And so he systematically tried to remove them from the federal government. This is something we should be reminding our PBA friends about, just how Donald Trump is public enemy number one when it comes to organized labor. So he left vacant the Merit Service Protection Board. All of the architecture that's put into place before the Watergate reforms, guaranteed to enforce the Hatch Act and all these other things, he has been dismantling.
Well, look at the Federal Election Commission too, Bob.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody making sure that illegal money doesn't come to a political candidate, to the extent that our Constitution and our courts allow there to be any supervision of that. There's nobody on. Nobody at the police shop. Nobody on.
But Dean, what is interesting to me is not only has he not made the appointments and there are just vacancies everywhere, but everyone is temporary. Everyone, Dean, is temporary. That's another brilliant strategy, because temporary means you don't have to be vetted by the Senate. Nobody meets. I mean, you're really under the thumb of the president. So in a lot of ways, is he that clever? Or is there like this master planner that knows exactly what to do? Because I have, my understanding was that Donald Trump only ran the family shop. And the family shop didn't have a lot of employees. He didn't understand a bureaucracy because he was everything. So it's not like he was a great CEO with a huge company that he was, you know, in charge of. It was like a mom and pop shop. You know, it was much bigger than my radio station. And yet at the same time, when you're looking at how masterful it is that he is conducting this authoritarian move, I am trying to figure out who is giving him guidance, Dean. Who is writing the plan and basically developing the script? Because I know he didn't have that skill set, but for whatever reason, he has developed an incredible genius when it comes to being able to dismantle and take over this government, Dean.
Yeah, well, he's figured out where the loopholes are in kind of the norms that function and keep our institutions functioning. So, you know, part of it is just him wanting to recreate the kind of family business. We've talked about that before, that we knew that he was kind of inexorably marching towards this kind of a setup where all the people who came in initially who were supposedly the guardrails, you know, whether it's, you know, Gary Cohen or James Mattis or a number of other, even Reince Priebus, so there's various people who had institutional experience and were considered kind of guardrails. Those folks were all gone. Even someone like Don McGahn, the White House lawyer. So, but we knew he was kind of moving in this direction. He has certainly had people along the way, whether it's Stephen Miller or William Barr or others, who have kind of aided and abetted this type of behavior. But, you know, he's kind of made a career out of finding loopholes, cutting corners, sort of figuring out how to get things the way he wants them at a very kind of instinctive level almost. He's basically recreated that.
Right, I need to cut off the conversation right now so we can go to a break, but I just want to make a point. he has a level of sophistication, because if you look at all the real estate deals he's done in the United States, and the fact that he didn't go to jail 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 7 years ago, means it's a level of sophistication that he does have. Unfortunately, it never occurred to me what that would mean when it puts him in the presidency. So anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We'll be right back, and we'll have again with us Dean Spiliotis, Stephen Pimper, and Robert Henley. Welcome back to Part 2 of Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Joining us, as they did in the beginning of the show, is Robert Henley. Robert Henley writes for The Chief Leader, Salon.com, Insider NJ, at Stuck Nation. He's a prolific writer, and we're so glad that we've grabbed him because he knows so much about public sector unions and obviously focuses a lot on what's happening in the great state of New York and New Jersey. So welcome back to the program, Bob.
Thanks.
And joining us is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome back, Dean.
Hi, Arnie.
And Stephen Pimper teaches at UNH Manchester and is a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. Welcome back, Stephen.
Hi, Arnie.
All right, we got to talk about what's breaking my heart. And what's breaking my heart is California and Oregon and Washington and the level of burning, Stephen. What is happening? I mean, we keep talking about the pandemics, and I talk about the pandemics as the pandemics of race, the pandemic of COVID, and the pandemic of climate change. And I kept saying, well, you know, the pandemic of COVID will kill you quickly. The pandemic of racism has been around for a long time. And if you're a person of color, that's the target of who gets killed. But climate change was kind of a slow burn. Well, not anymore, Stephen. It's a fast burn. And it is only halfway through the burn season in places like California and Oregon and Washington. And already we have seen a level of devastation and the level of people dying and towns and blocks being completely eliminated and the inability to contain it, in part, not only because it is so astronomical, covering so many millions of acres, but the people that would be assisting in fighting this fire are prisoners who have now contracted COVID and are not available, or firefighters who have been vulnerable because of COVID. So we're looking at a situation where it's building on each other and the synergistic effect is worse than even what we see, Stephen.
Fun fact in context is, of course, that the 13th Amendment, which theoretically abolished slavery, carved out a specific exception for people who had been convicted of felonies, which is in part how we use what is in effect slave labor for cheap essential public services. Something on the order of 10% of the population of Oregon is now under an evacuation order. Not just California, Washington, Oregon, there are fires out of control in Colorado. If you noticed a couple of days ago, flooding throughout Washington, D.C. because of a surprise storm. Remember, what was it last week or the week before? Dual hurricanes moving into Louisiana and Texas. There are a number of those forming out in the Atlantic that seem to be on their way. Remember, last year, large chunks of Iowa and the breadbasket Midwest underwater from flooding. And just last year, Australia on fire, the ways in which the American West Coast is currently on fire. Climate change is not a thing that we need to be preparing for in the future. It's here. This is what it looks like. And we are quickly losing opportunities to stop it from spinning so quickly out of control that forget about hitting the epic 3 degree, 4 degree centigrade target. We could be exceeding that given the way that we seem to be discovering new feedback effects, right? As things get bad, they get often even worse than the worst case scenario projected. So I mean, and this gets back to sort of the problem of government dysfunction, right? If there were a moment we've talked about in the context of a pandemic, right, when it might be useful to have a fully competent functioning national government that was able to work in concert with national governments around the world, this is literally existential, right, for large chunks of the human population. And I right now, today, am unconvinced that we collectively are up to the challenge. And that is as terrifying as what we can expect from the pandemic in the fall, or more so.
So there are two stories, Bob Henley, that sort of touch on this. One of the stories was from ProPublica. And the story in ProPublica was talking about that people who live in polluted areas suffer greater consequences from COVID-19.
Right.
Well, you know, people in San Francisco never thought they lived in a polluted area. They now do. Right. People in Oregon never thought they lived in a polluted area outside of Portland. They now do. Because what this fire has done is not only spread ash everywhere, not only made, you know, conditions impossible to breathe, so you're forced inside, but even being inside doesn't necessarily, you know, give you respite. So we're seeing a situation where they're talking about pockets of folks that live in polluted areas in Louisiana and in Texas, but now because of these fires, the umbrella of pollution now has spread over places that historically, that was not part of the game. That was not part of the plan. That's one. And then there was a National Geographic story. And again, I want to remind people, we depend on places like California for our fruits and vegetables. That what goes into our grocery store comes from places like that. And they were talking about in the National Geographic, listen to the title, An Extraordinary Summer of Crises for California's Farm Workers. The essential workers picking America's food are facing fires, heat waves, and the pandemic all at once.
Right.
Those two stories are bookends as to what we're seeing happening with the flames that are literally eating up so much of the West.
Right. And so this is also a consequence of land use decisions that are continuing to be made. I've had some experience traveling up in areas, Oregon and Northern California, and the way they pushed up those mountains and pushed settlement into places that environmentalists told them not to do. Also, the inability, we're dealing with this people power shortage, which is very real. And so if ever there, and then also there's a great crisis in terms of the aircraft used to fight these fires. There's such demand for them. So this is another example of the Defense Production Act, where we should be churning out the things like this that we're going to need. And also there is an epidemiological synergy here, because these conditions that are now ambient through so much of the Northwest and the Pacific region also then will start to exacerbate the conditions that people with pre-existing conditions already have, asthma and the rest, and make them more vulnerable to COVID. So, and again, the lack of presidential leadership, the disconnect from the circumstance of people on the ground from this, and also consider that we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars of borrowed money on a national defense, and that the catastrophes that are this existential threat have nothing to do with what we've been spending our money on. And there's no sign, with the exception of a few enlightened people like Senator Sanders, that they're going to make that Buckminster Fuller adaptation, the trim tab effect, to start saying, let's stop spending all this money on defense from things that are not likely to be our big problem when we have clear and present dangers now on at least two fronts.
So Dean, the other thing that terrifies me is that we're talking about, you know, more than, and Stephen is right, it's more than Washington and Oregon and California, but for the most part, a lot of it is focused on those three states. And what do we know about Donald Trump? Does he give a crap about Oregon or Washington or California? They could burn as far as he's concerned. He hasn't talked about it. He hasn't, I mean, the governor of Oregon wrote a whole series about how what's happening in her state and how she had sent a message to the administration. And what did she hear back, Dean? Crickets. Crickets. People are dying. This is a fire. He wants to send in the National Guard and the military on voting day. Well, you know what? Maybe this is an opportunity for them to figure out how they're going to fight fires. You know, I mean, it's crickets, nothing. As they have never, I mean, California at least has some experience dealing with these fires. Oregon has niente. They have never dealt with this before. This is a case of first impression. So not only do they have to get up to speed, but they're being overwhelmed and there's no support. This is just, it's beyond shocking.
Yeah. Well, you know, the folks in those states, as Trump would say, are not his people. He doesn't see any, there's no electoral benefit. He feels like they have not been sufficiently solicitous of his attention. You know, he's been very critical of the governor of Washington, Jay Inslee. I saw both Inslee and Senator Merkley from Oregon on this morning on some of the Sunday shows. And, you know, they've said this is a climate crisis. These aren't just wildfires. But that they keep getting, Trump said this at a rally over the weekend, that it's forest management, that, you know, they're not doing enough timber harvesting and raking the floor of the forest, the brush. And, you know, both Merkley and Inslee said, you know, these aren't those type of fires. It's sort of irrelevant to the underlying causes. But they've known all along that they're not going to get much help from him. I thought he said he was going to go visit, which may actually make things a little bit worse.
Dean, even if it were a matter of forest management, who is the executive in charge of the United States Forest Service?
Yeah, exactly.
Really? Exactly. It's not the state.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he views it as a state problem.
Yeah, no, it's the situation is shocking. So Joe Biden is running against Donald Trump. And I just heard Bernie Sanders sort of do a little bit of a critique of Biden's campaign. And one of the critiques about his campaign is that he's really not talking enough about economic issues, all right? He's talking a lot about the pandemic and COVID and mask wearing and that, but he's not talking about the economic issues. And I think Bernie has obviously always been focused on that. That describes his career for 40 years, but it's not just his history. It's that the one place that Donald Trump is still doing well on is the economy. So that you don't make everything economic, I don't care what it is you talk about, seems to me to be good advice, not just from Bernie, but understanding why Donald Trump is even doing as well as he's doing, which shocks me. But yet the fact that I am afraid he might win tells you that there is a success strategy here. And the economy is what he is using effectively, despite the fact that so many people are in financial despair.
Even in normal times, political scientists argue about the value of one particular campaign expenditure versus another, right? How much does television advertising really do? Yada, yada, right? This is not normal times, right? So I am sort of loath to second guess how that money could be spent. I think we also don't know how the money is being spent, right? We're not seeing a lot of that local television advertising. We're not seeing the social media expenditures and which sort of ads are running in those kinds of places. We're not seeing what they're doing in terms of probably not door to door, but by telephone, text, and email voter outreach, yada, yada, yada. That having been said, going back to where we started earlier, it seems to me utterly delusional to imagine that we are walking into a free and fair election. Right. And, you know, we've always, somebody sort of mentioned Kennedy, right? It's like, there's still a good argument, right, that Kennedy stole the 1960 election, right? It's like, so we have a long history of being pretty bad at running democratic elections, despite the ways in which we hold ourselves up to the rest of the world as the paragon of that, right? So in that context, right, this is a whole nother world, right? We've seen just this week, Florida Supreme Court, 5 out of 6 judges who are Trump appointees, essentially upholding the poll tax. And I think any reasonable read of that reads that as a poll tax. It requires people who, by public referendum, were allowed to vote after certain categories of people after fulfilling their prison sentences. The state of Florida is now not only saying that they must pay fees and fines, but they are explicitly acknowledging that there is no central repository that can tell people how much they actually owe. If that is not rat blanking an election, I don't know what is. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, right, we've got the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, very heavily Republican, very heavily politicized for a court, that has suspended ballots that are already being distributed, considering whether a Green Party candidate who does not meet the threshold to go on the ballot should be put on the ballot, right? And I feel like I'm missing one. There was a third state just this week. Texas. Texas court upheld the decision that only people over the age of 65 could get mail-in ballots, citing COVID as an excuse, right? So we've already got, on top of all the ordinary disenfranchisement, right? We know low-income communities have fewer voting machines, they're older, they work less, there's a longer wait, yada, yada, yada. On top of all the ordinary stuff, right, we've got this growing evidence of systematic disenfranchisement. Even if we imagine that we're going to be able to count votes in any kind of way in the weeks after November, and I don't believe that we will be able to in a way that doesn't involve all of the lawyers in the known Western universe. Even so, right, we have no way of counting how many people were prevented from showing up in the first place.
So Bob, I, one of the things I keep thinking about is that, so Donald Trump is looking at it saying, so anyone who votes absentee or votes by mail, that is potentially a vote that cannot be trusted. Only voting on election day can be a vote that can be trusted. And what he is basically doing is, even though historically Republicans had voted by mail, he is now sort of sending out the message, I want my maskless, non-socially distancing people to show up on election day. Don't worry about it. You're not going to get COVID. You're not going to die. Stand online and vote. I'm beginning to think that maybe I have an imperative. And that is, I have to physically stand online on election day, cover myself with a mask, cover myself with a body mask if I have to, because I don't want him to win on election day. I want him to lose on election day. I want him to lose on the week after election day. I want him to lose after they collect all the absentee ballots. I want him every way, shape, or form. I don't want any question as to what the numbers might be at midnight on election day versus a day after. And I think in a lot of ways, that's really what the case is that he's building. He wants the Democrats to vote by mail because he knows by definition that there will be a delay in a result. And therefore, he can grab the immediacy of whatever that result is on election day because he's sent his minions in to die and vote for him.
Well, one of the things that we need to do is really focus on something that is already upon us, which is the challenge of the overseas military vote. And yeah. So we need to use, to riff off of the great reporting in The Atlantic about Trump's disrespect for the military and point out that his shenanigans will have the net effect of doing something that hasn't happened ever, I think, going back to the Civil War, to disenfranchise soldiers that we all care so much about for the selfless sacrifice that are now going to be their franchise be put at risk. So I do think that the Biden people need to be more nimble, and they need to drive these kinds of issues home. And similarly, the same thing with Trump clinging on to this concept that he's the representative of Blue Lives Matter. And then look at the death toll of sheriff deputies and EMTs and police that have died from COVID. The other thing too here is that it's very important to have a physical presence. Remember, there's some great reporting about how the 2000 vote was, it wasn't just lost in the Supreme Court, but the way that they got into those county places and created all of that agitprop were just activists who had an agenda, far right-wing people, that made it impossible for people to canvass the vote. So I think that it's not enough to just do the solitary act, civic act of voting, but to be engaged locally with like the National Lawyers Guild and to make sure that there is a presence at the poll, wherever you are, to support people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So I want to get into the nitty-gritty, Dean. Let's talk about Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman has come out in support of Susan Collins. And they keep talking about Joe Lieberman, this great Democrat. First of all, didn't he leave the Democratic Party?
He did.
Am I right? Didn't he actually at one point endorse Donald Trump? Remember when he was in, what is it, there? He was in that flavor, that third way or the whatever, there was like this group that he formed that, and I believe they were saying, if not nice things about Donald Trump, that he almost sort of endorsed Donald Trump. So when they roll out Joe Lieberman and he talks about being the VP with Al Gore, and I like want to put my middle fingers up in stereo, and they constantly, nobody reminds everyone that he ain't a Democrat anymore. And what he is doing by endorsing Susan Collins and supporting Susan Collins is making sure that Mitch McConnell maintains his control over the United States Senate, which is the worst thing that could happen if he claims to still be a Democrat, which he ain't. I mean, this is just so shocking to me that I keep waiting for someone to sort of rehabilitate the record. If I hear them describe him as a Democrat one more time, I'm going to break my television set. Because it's just a fiction and a lie. And that's what's so shocking about this. And Susan Collins, when she was asked about, you know, whether she would be supporting Donald Trump and whether she thinks Mainers should support Donald Trump. And her answer was something to the effect is, well, I don't think Mainers need to know what I think. And they need to make their own decision as to like who they're supporting. I'm thinking, how much did she pay a consultant for that answer? Because it was the most incredible punt I had ever heard. But I'm looking at this, and the Susan Collins race is not just a main race, it is a huge race when we're talking about the control of the United States Senate.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, a lot of analysts view it as kind of a pivot point or a bellwether for Democrats taking control of the Senate. Yeah, if Gideon's unable to win in Maine, that's a bad sign. There was an interesting article I read yesterday, I think it was Politico, trying to explain how Susan Collins went from being one of the most popular senators to literally the least popular senator in the U.S. Senate. And it looked at a lot of the changes in how people viewed, you know, whether or not she really was this kind of independent bulwark, or if when push comes to shove, she typically fell in line with McConnell and others. And the latter is what you find out when you really look at kind of the key decisions she's made. I watched that Lieberman ad. It's got like no energy. I don't know what they think is going to come of it. You know, Lieberman is somebody who I've watched over the years pretty closely. You know, he ran again in 2004 and basically was eliminated after New Hampshire. He finished fourth or fifth place. He's become increasingly bitter over a number. You know, here's a guy who basically thought he should have been vice president, taken away from him. And then his own party, essentially, as it became more progressive and as the DLC kind of lost favor, he got kind of pushed to the side. And he's been increasingly bitter. I don't know that it's going to have all that much of an impact.
But why isn't he bitter with Republicans? Let me just say, why isn't he bitter with Republicans? Because the understanding is John McCain wanted him as his VP. And it was the Republican Party that basically said, no way in hell is he going to be your VP. And that's how we got the Queen.
Well, these kind of, I mean, it may be if you switch parties, but these kind of unity tickets, it's a bit of, I thought even back then it would have been seen as a stunt. you know, Lieberman could have switched parties. I think he preferred to call himself an independent. But, you know, for whatever reason, he's had no, I don't know anybody who's looking to Lieberman for any kind of signaling politically at this point. You know, maybe it's a little bit of a you-know-what to Democrats in the rearview mirror. But, yeah, it just seemed kind of odd. And like I said, I watched the ad. It's not a particularly a notable ad. You know, I don't know that it's going to make much of a difference.
Right. But the packaging of him as a Democrat is something that is just to me so offensive. And the fact that the reporters are not correcting the record to me is just, I think it's just outrageous, to be honest with you. But maybe that's just my thing. We have not talked about the most provocative book of the day. I mean, I feel like every couple of days there's another book coming out that sort of trashes Donald Trump. But the Woodward book is, I think, the most interesting because it's not just a book, it's a book on tape. And I don't mean the book on tape, it's the tape, the book, the tape. I mean, this is like something I've never seen before. But that's how Woodward operates. He always operates where he's got the tape on. Will this make a difference, Stephen Pimpare? I mean, everything on that tape, people are like shocked.
No.
That Donald Trump actually understood that it went through the air, the COVID spread, that they're actually, I think he knew everything because there was an obligation on the part of the bureaucracy and his support staff to tell him everything. The fact that he basically lied, that he didn't listen to them, or he decided I'm going to push this to the back of the bus because I'm going to talk you out of the pandemic, that it just reinforces what we all kind of knew. It wasn't that he didn't know. He chose not to share it.
It's unclear to me how much new information is there when all is said and done, right? If you're if you're paying attention, there's nothing particularly surprising here. I do wonder, going back to something that Bob said earlier about military overseas ballots, whether the different set of statements about Trump disparaging veterans of foreign war and Americans who have lost their lives in foreign wars, whether that may, you know, sort of again play. I mean, clearly Biden is playing a let's pull over some undecided Republicans kind of strategy. Surely that creates an opening for the campaign to go at, again, some of those who are gettable, right? I mean, I don't know what this number is, but, you know, Trump's got a floor and it doesn't seem to be moving too terribly much. But keep in mind that if we look at the Electoral College in 2016, three states and 77,000 votes was the total difference, right, between the official count for Clinton and Trump. So a handful of votes here and there that he's able to pull over by exploiting, again, those sort of centrist claims that who Trump is telling you he is not who he is, and he's disrespectful of everyone who doesn't kowtow to him. Maybe there's a space there to pull in a few.
I'm going to end with you, Bob, because you're the reporter in the family. And that is, people have been chastising Bob Woodward for sitting on these tapes for so long, that these tapes were of greater value than just in the publication of a book, that they really sort of pointed to a lot of things, some of the things that Stephen, for example, has disclosed. Do you think that Bob had an obligation to share?
I am really troubled, particularly the disclosure that the president was aware and believed to be true that this was airborne.
Yeah.
And I do think that that is, but then I've always parted company with Mr. Woodward. His idea that it was a good idea for Gerald Ford to pardon Richard Nixon, and that set a new stage, and let's give him an award. I never believed it because I thought they should have had a show trial to finish off the rest of the corrupt people around Richard Nixon. And who knows, we might not have had Donald Trump if we had had a full disclosure of all
the corrupt people. I think that's exactly right.
That's a great, what a great point to end.
And it's not just a show trial either. It's an actual being held accountable for what they did.
Right. A fabulous Rethink the Week, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bob Henelis, Stephen Pimpare, and Dean Spiliotis.
Thanks, Arnie.
My producer, Ken Barnes. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You're going to take away my energy with all your